I mix what I like.
So what's up, world? Welcome to another edition of I Mix What I Like. imixwhatilike.org for more on this conversation and more. Again, I'm Jared Ball. Happy to be your host. Again, with me is the legend himself, Daruba Bin Wahad, former member of the Black Panther Party, former member of the Black Liberation Army, former political prisoner, and one of my favorite political analysts still doing it. Daruba, again, thank you for joining me and welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you, Jared. This is totally unexpected.
You're right. So, but it's great because on the one hand, so you sent me this email with your critique of my interview with Dr. Leslie Alexander about her review of Birth of a Nation. And as I admit, you know, I never want to be on the opposite end of your criticism, but it is what it is, and it's deserving, and it's relevant. So let me at least let you share your critique of our conversation with Dr. Alexander, and then if I can offer up some kind of response. But please go ahead.
Yeah. So you want to do that first?
Well, yeah. Let's start there because I want to make sure that gets in, and because I think what you have to lay out there is relevant to anything else that we're going to end up talking about anyway.
Well, you know, Jared, you know, I got a whole lot of respect for you and Mark and brothers and sisters like Sister Alexander, man, because you guys, man, you know, y'all serve a serious purpose.
But just for the record, Mark doesn't agree with me on this either. So I don't want people who see this to lump him in with this either.
Me and Mark, we have another dialogue because he hit me up with something that he was doing on the Nat Turner thing.
Right.
And it was the family of Nat Turner, and he It was a unique opportunity to connect his class and the young brothers and sisters he was dealing with this legacy of struggle and all of this stuff. And I basically went off on that, but not for the same reasons, actually, or maybe they were. It's hard to explain this, man, because I feel that without people like you and Mark and that sister, you know, our story would never even get considered to be told accurately. You know, and so it's not that I'm anti-academician, especially when there's black scholars like yourselves who have politics, who have revolutionary perspectives, who understand the value of information as intelligence. You know, and that can never be replaced. I've always said that the real mark of a good teacher is that they turn out revolutionaries, that they turn out activists, that they inspire people to take their lives more seriously and do things in the future. We all have a role. But sometimes, man, I listen to this, like I listen to that interview, and then the sister starts pointing out, well, you know, like she was talking about the kid that didn't exist, that was portrayed as a snitch, and therefore this is what comes out. But this is not what comes, this is what comes out the end, is that we can't really form a movement without somebody in our midst snitching on us. You see what I'm saying? And then he winds up in a uniform, in a union uniform, which basically then portrays it as that he did the right thing, because, you know, the black extreme, the revolutionaries and Nat Turner just took it too far. You see what I'm saying? And I get that. And I get that the sister spent a considerable amount of her studies and her life, you know, trying to get through the crap of history that's been bestowed on us so she could come up with a reasonable portrayal of what really happened. But none of us were there. See, and this is my point, that the subjective factor in struggle, in liberation, and in freedom fighting is the dynamic factor. I think we all agree that that's one of the things that we found fascinating about Frantz Fanon, is that he connected the psychological and the subjective factor to the whole idea and the concept of struggle and resisting a colonialism. And it was an eye-opener for us. I mean, I know it was an eye-opener for me, okay, Richard of the Earth, and the subsequent volumes. But what we have come to now, and I feel that this was the crux of my, when I said I was shaking my head, is that people like the sister and academicians, they don't take this to the streets. I mean, there's thousands of soldiers out there, literally, black kids on the streets that would just as soon punch a cracker in the face than punch his time clock. Okay? They're ready to struggle, but they don't have that academic rigor that requires that you had to go through just to be a professor. You had to be disciplined and have some academic rigor and go through a whole process of discerning information and facts from fiction. You had to be disciplined in doing this. And that's the type of leadership that's missing on that street. That's the type of discipline that's missing when these young brothers and sisters who want to do something, like the brothers and sisters in Ferguson, when they come up to a professor, what is the professor telling them? Well, you ain't going to win. Or, you know, white folks got this and they got that. And we don't have no intellectual black Illuminati sitting down plotting a course through history that we can then follow, that we can then, whether we want to or not, begin to implement. So my thing is, what is bothering me is that we have went through generations of this, from Baldwin all the way up to now, you know, that tell us that this type of mind power, this type of academic rigor needs to be disseminated to the grassroots in a way that they can relate and understand. And I haven't seen the movie Nat Turner, okay? But I intend to go see it, hopefully, maybe this evening with my wife when she gets back from work. But I know that when I see this movie, my identification with Nat Turner is not going to be trying to discern fact from fiction. It's not going to try to substitute the director's personal angst from what he put in the movie. That's not how it's going to hit me. It's going to hit me feeling like I know what it's like to be hunted like that. I know what it feels like to be underground. I know what it's like to face an indomitable enemy. I know what this feels like. So I'm identifying with Nat on that level. If you understand what I'm saying.
To the extent possible, yeah. But see, this is, and I can't speak for Dr. Alexander, for Leslie. I can't speak for her. But for me, feeling like I'm maybe similarly situated, I don't know. I can't really speak for her on that. But for me, the issue isn't, the reason I wanted to be engaged in her critique and critique of the film in general is for a different reason than I think than what I hear you saying. My reason for critiquing the film and what I got from her criticism of the film wasn't to say that we are, or that I know what's best in terms of what to do about our problem, or that I'm willing to, or that I don't want people to engage in armed struggle because it's going to get snitched on and it can't fail. My reasoning is the exact opposite. My critique is that my concern includes, part of my concern is that the way they portray the rebellion, the way they portray that little boy, the way they portray that is to speak against these tendencies that you talk about in our communities that might lend ourselves to that kind of activity. I don't want to discourage it. I'm not advocating. Don't get me. I don't want people out there missing.
No,
but what I'm saying is
discouraging it.
No,
I don't think she's discouraging it neither. She indicated that there's not a rebellion that we went through that she doesn't relate to. I got that part. Okay. I never even thought for one second that you were discouraging it, or that she was disparaging or discouraging the idea, the notion of.
In fact, I was criticizing what I thought the film was doing by saying that the film was attempting to discourage it by saying, this is what's going to happen. The snitch is going to snitch on you and then become himself the more accepted. So you got to see the film. I didn't know you hadn't seen the film. You got to see how they portray this little boy afterwards, because I think it's the scene of him becoming a grown man fighting for the Union Army that is the symbolic attempt of this film to say, you can't fight for yourself, but you can pick up a gun for us.
And but they've been saying that all this time.
Yeah, well, but
Ock said that we could kill for the Empire.
Exactly. But the film and it's and Nate Parker's post film promotional campaign of using the film to encourage people to register to vote is exactly my point. that the film is being used to say armed struggle was okay only, maybe only in 1831, but not now. And now, if you want to satisfy the legacy of Nat Turner, you have to register to vote, and that's about all the radical activity that's being encouraged. So that's where I was concerned. And so I'm saying, agreeing with Leslie, that if you're going to take license with the history, then one, don't claim that the film is real history, and then B, take license in a more progressive or radical direction.
But you see, for the brother on the streets, that don't matter. You remember the guy that wrote you the response, said that cracker getting his head cut off was sufficient for him?
Yeah.
It's sufficient for the brother on the streets that the cracker's head is in somebody's hand. It's sufficient. What we need in analyzing this is we need that brain power that y'all have, rather than talk about how, well, okay, they're trying to put it in this, to say, look, this is the type of movement that has to be done. And this is why we have to do it this way. You know, and this is what's needed. We know there's going to be Negroes that snitch. We know, the BLA never had an infiltrator. People don't know that. But the BLA was never infiltrated until there were comrades that were captured here in Georgia. And one was flipped while in captivity. And when everybody escaped, he escaped with them. Okay? So we know that that's a possibility of betrayal. That's always a possibility. But you don't care. All this head is sufficient. His head being cut off is sufficient. Okay? If Zimmerman is still walking around today, he's walking around because there's no network of retribution that exists. There's none. When these popo come, when the guns are drawn, this is what I was telling you, when the guns are drawn and they come down on these brothers and sisters who are for the right reasons in the streets for Black Lives Matter, they have no underground to flee to like Asada did. There is none. They have built none. There have been no erudite academicians who understand history and say, hey, this is necessary. Let me begin to try to put this out in a way.
That part is not true. That little part is not true. There may not be enough of those academicians, but see, and I know for a fact that there have been attempts. See, that's why I try to say, like, we can't always judge. I don't know everything that Leslie does outside of that interview or outside of her professional career, nor does she know that about me, nor does anyone else. So I'm always a little bit careful. I want to be, you know, like, we don't know what anyone is doing after they finish with these video interviews. Most of us don't know, at least. But then I can say, and I have been present and have participated myself or attempted to participate myself in performing the role you're talking about of trying to fill in some of those intellectual gaps to the extent that we see them, to the extent that it's possible to do that. So I just want to put that little, you know.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I started out by saying, yeah. I appreciate brothers and sisters. Like, if you remember in my last response, I talked about how you corrected. I forgot that guy's name.
Manning Marable.
There he is, Manning. See how you forget the inconsequential Negroes? Manning Marable. Now, I knew Manning Marable. Manning Marable was a punk in the movement all his life.
Oh, wow.
He was always a punk. You know, now, and then he comes up after Malcolm dies, and he puts out a book to rewrite Malcolm's legacy, rewrite Malcolm's character, and all that. That's what punks do, okay? That's what punks do. And if you notice that when he brought that book out, it became the topic of discussion across the so-called movement, across the academia. People were having conferences and teachings on this guy's book, on the efficacy or the truth of his book. Okay.
Just for the record, our argument, at least the argument I helped put forth, didn't argue about Manning Marable being a punk in the movement. You have a credibility.
She used to do that.
No, I'm just saying you have a credibility that not a lot of us have, and that was not my perspective.
I know it wasn't.
So I read your book,
and I know it wasn't. And you did your role. That's what I said.
I just want to make sure if you didn't write that book.
If you didn't write that book, there might not be no young person out there that would have that argument on understanding how he has distorted Malcolm's legacy. Okay? I couldn't write that book.
Okay. Flip side is also that most young people probably have not read his book, which may be in fact a good thing. But that sort of speaks to the point that when you're saying to many young cats in the street who see the one head cut off, that's all they need. My argument, And I hope I'm wrong, but my argument, at least about what I think is the intent of the film, and specifically the intent of the supporters and backers of the film, is that they know those cats feel that way. They know that there are a lot of us out here that have a tendency to feel that way. So they want to give us a version of the display of that violence that is safe. That, in other words, I don't think those who are not already feeling that way are going to be encouraged to that by seeing the film. I think in the exact opposite. I think the film works to weaken that tendency, that stream of thought, because that's why you get 90 minutes of just African suffering across the board, and then just a few minutes of this rebellion. And in terms of what's seen on screen, there's no comparison. You get the one head, yes, but the violence on screen is overwhelmingly suffered by Black people.
But that's a Hollywood device. You know, that's the device of Hollywood. You know, before the white superhero goes around fire blasting everybody, you know, his baby gets killed, his wife gets murdered by the terrorists, and then that justifies him going buck wild on everything he opposes. I mean, we know that from every major movie that's come out. That's a device, okay? And it's a device to rationalize and justify the violence that will follow. Okay, and for white folks, it's a justification for the violence that will follow. In this case, what you're saying in the movie, it's used as a diversion, really, from the ultimate truth that the violence can only be, your retribution can only be established through the system and via working for the fighting in the U.S. military. But I think that, you know, we have a generation of young folks that are weaned on that device, so it's like so they know that. That all of the suffering is just making them mad. Okay, all of the suffering is making them mad. So it's obviously having the opposite effect. It's making them mad and identify more with Nat Turner than with the kid that's supposed to be a snitch. And that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we need brothers and sisters. I am not saying you. We need brothers and sisters like yourself and Sister Alexander, you understand, to be our I don't know what word terms I should use. Should be our skull society, or whatever, our black hand, whatever you want to call it, because you guys are too intelligent, too aware of these devices, just like you pointed out. You understand, to not inform those individuals who can be leaders on the streets, who can pick up on what you're saying on a one-on-one or insight with some type of network, you understand, so that they could put it into practice. Okay, that's the difference. The difference is we have an intellectual elite in the black academia that don't put their shit into practice. And so they missed the historical moment. Like, we could sit up here and pontificate all day about this election that's coming off. And about the forces that Trump has unleashed unwittingly as a straw dog Hillary, okay? But the fact of the matter is that we have to have a response. We have to have a protection for us. There has to be someone that has a doctor in front of their name, you understand, that goes up on the 10 most wanted list, not based on anything that they did, but on based on the thoughts that they've managed to project. If you recall this sheikh, they call him the blind sheikh. I don't know if you remember
this blind sheikh.
You remember how they talked about how this blind sheikh, he was actually the spiritual and religious guru of all these terrorist organizations, from Hezbollah to Hamas to Al-Qaeda, right? This man ain't bust a grape with a ball-peen hammer. It was his ideas and his persona and authority of what he said that inspired other young folks to do this, to do what they did. Now, I'm not saying that what he inspired them to do was necessarily correct. And I'm not endorsing his particular brand of jihadism or whatever people may interpret for him. But I'm saying that all movements have people that are heads and above intellectually and academically and everybody else, including their enemy. Okay, and these are the ones that people draw sustenance from. These are the ones that people on the streets quote. Everybody quotes Malcolm. You know, everybody quotes Malcolm because Malcolm was clear on a lot of things. There's a point in time where certain leaders also exhibit charismatic as well as intellectual leadership. is in one person. That happens. But some of us, unfortunately, are not necessarily blessed with both of those things at the same time. Everybody's not that, you know, not that blessed. So we got to pick and choose. We got to have different ones to serve a different purpose. And all I'm simply saying is when I see these interviews like that, where the sister would say that, you know, that that Nat Turner, you know, wasn't in this tradition, or he, you know, I understand what she's saying when they try to portray, you know, Christianity as the basis of his resistance. You know, we've been all told about how, you know, he saw Jesus, God in the vision, and he was motivated by all of that. You understand? But they said the same thing about Muhammad. And half of the world are Muslim. Okay, so it doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Okay, it really, really doesn't matter. It only matters to intellectuals. Because that would be, I mean, that could recruit Cephalo Dollar's crew. I mean, Cephalo Dollar tells you that Jesus wants them to be, to have some money. And he's selling handkerchiefs with blessings on them. You see what I'm saying? All I'm simply saying is when our great minds and our great historians devote themselves solely to contradicting the dialogue or the representation of our history without connecting that to people on the streets and what they're going through today, right now, and how they can resist so that we can build something. Okay, so that something will outlast us. You know, one of the things, great things that you have going for you, and a lot of brothers and sisters have, like Sister Alexander, is that you guys wrote books, and those books are going to outlive you. Okay? They're going to be here when you're dead and gone. Okay? And some young brother somewhere, maybe in a cell in one of these prisons, will pick up your book and read that, and it transform their consciousness. Huh? And I'm saying that that's necessary. But you can also transform their consciousness while you're here. Okay? You can do it. And it can be done. And now's the historical moment to do it. It's one thing for people like me to come out and say, you know, we need to do this and we need to pick up this and we need to do that. Everybody, well, there goes Daruba again. You see what I'm saying? He was crazy from Jump Street.
Right.
So we know where that's coming from. You understand what I'm saying? But when an Alexander says, you understand, this is how a movement needs to be built. And our historical lessons taught us that this is why it has to be built. The brother that'll pick that book up, the sister that'll pick that book up 5 years from now, 6 years from now, and that's at that point in their life when they want to make a life-changing decision, that book would be important.
But that book doesn't
exist.
The only I hear you and I appreciate everything you're saying, and the only thing I would want to try to say, I can't speak for Dr. Alexander, but what I've felt like that interview did and her review did, and the work I know I'm trying to do is to try to perform that task, to at least give someone, whether it's another academic, another intellectual, another, you know, someone in the street, wherever, another way of interpreting the document, in this case, the film. And in that sense, that's why I don't fully get some of the backlash that I've gotten personally for that particular interview, or that I think that Leslie has gotten for her work on this issue, because I think somewhere that point is being missed, that I feel like at least that's what what you're asking be done is what we were trying to do, to say, look, we know that this document is being given to people in the community, in the world, in the street, wherever, and we're trying to at least speak for myself. I was trying to, am trying to add a radical depth to that document to encourage what I think you're talking about. So I'm not seeing it as the critique trying to work against the film enhancing people's radicalism in the street. I'm trying to get them to use the film to make it even more intense.
But you see, it has the opposite effect. It encourages punks.
Wow.
It encourages punks because they see, we can't resist. You see?
But that's not what we're saying. In fact, that's what we're saying. That's what the movie's trying to tell us.
That's what you're saying that the movie is telling you. What I'm saying is your critique of it is just like Manny Marable's critique of it. People, the brothers on the streets ain't the brothers that would pick up the cudgel of physical defense, they don't take it that way. You see what I mean? I talk to these brothers, they don't take it that way. They'll take it to mean the complete opposite of what you intend, because you brought out that contradiction. Okay, and you showed how the movie was showing that, you know, you could only resist if you go this route. That the sister made a very vivid illustration when she said, I mean, she broke it down. I mean, the sister broke it down. And there's no doubt about that. She broke down that dialectic that you were just talking about. She broke it down. She broke it down very well. You see, and if I had seen the movie already, that might have shot past me. You see what I'm saying? But now when I go see the movie, I'm on guard now. My fist is up. Yeah, they're going to bring forth this bogus snitch. They're going to bring forth this bogus snitch. You understand what I'm saying? And before you know, he's going to be marching off, you know, into the sunset in a Union uniform. You understand what I'm saying? But the thing is that we know that once you were in the BLA, you weren't getting drafted into the military. You were not going into the army. You could not march off into the sunset after you was an Assata Shakur. You understand? They were not going to recruit you. You were not going to be allowed into the U.S. military. So presenting that dynamic is lost on the Crip or the Blood in the street, because he wasn't going to go into the military anyway. You see what I'm saying? And he didn't believe in that anyhow. Okay? So it's lost on him. But it's not lost on a teacher in elementary school. It's not lost on someone, a student of Black history in the classroom, who probably would never pick up the gun to begin with. That's why they're a student of history in the Black in the college campus. So what I'm saying is, I told you, man, that when doing this interview on the spur of the moment might make me sound crazy. You understand? It's just that I know how it feels to be hunted, and I know how it feels to be in that position and to have to trust the brother or sister next to you. You understand what I'm saying? With your life, you know, and I know how conspiracy, how we are painted as a conspiratorial a sect or a gang, and how we have to, I know how that feels. You see what I'm saying? And that's what I think is missing when we do this, that you don't, we don't give the feeling of what it was like to be a Nat Turner. You see what I'm saying? What it was like to be a Nat Turner. You know, if I go to sleep tonight and I have a dream about resurrecting the BLA, what could I say? I make a lot in the morning and say, God told me to do this. And then they're going to say I'm crazy 20 years from now. He was crazy anyway. You see what I'm saying? He was crazy anyway. I mean, we got messianic leaders. We got messianic leaders right today. And I don't have to mention no names, the foremost of which we know who he is. You understand? He'll tell you every day he talks to God. God talks to him. Now, who are you going to critique? What critique can you have for somebody that talks to God? What you got to say is irrelevant. And that's the whole point. What everybody had to say about Nat Turner and to Nat Turner was irrelevant. He was talking to God. You see? And whether God was Christian, whether he's Muslim or whatever, he told him to chop that head off. Okay? He told him to chop that head off. And all of that's in the past, in the scriptures, whether it's in the Quran or wherever. In the Quran, it tells you there can be no justice without retribution. And it's best for you, if you're a believer, to forgive. Didn't say that you have to forgive. It said it's better for you if you forgive. But if you take retribution, it's cool. You see what I'm saying? And that's what I'm saying. That's the message that has to get back. The message that's out there that you're trying to combat and that you're trying to deal with from the academic point of view is that it's the same message that came out of the Charlotte. Where the white boy went
South into Carolina,
the,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. South Carolina. He went into the church into a prayer thing with a gun, and actually had a conversation with the people before he murdered them, trying to convince, telling them why he had to kill them. And not one brother stood up there and said, look, let me tell you something, Crackle. You pull that trigger, I'm going to bust your ass. Nobody said nothing. It was all on some, we're going to pray for you, right? And no, that's the whole message that came out of that. That was no church that I would have been in. And that's no church that no brother on the streets would, everybody got that part. You see what I'm saying? We understand that they were enraptured by bullshit. That's why they let that cracker kill them. You understand? They should have been, well, you know, we tore him apart. You know, y'all, there's a piece of him over here and there's a piece over there. He came in our prayer conference threatening us with a gun. You know? Then we be marching in the street, free to Charlotte 7. You understand? Instead of praying for them. You see? It's the same thing with Zimmerman. Zimmerman is walking around in the street because there's no retribution. He ain't supposed to be walking around nowhere. Okay? And everybody says that. Everybody feels that, but nobody does nothing. You see what I'm saying? Nobody does know.
Well, except for the white man that got himself locked up for shooting at him.
Yeah, he got locked. And you remember just the recent shooting of the two cops. You know, you had every black person out here scared to death that it was a black guy that did it. Turned out it was a white supremacist.
Right.
So find out, now we've come to find out that the white supremacists who hate the police have more in common with us than we think.
Well, we, you know, when I saw that story, I you know, maybe this is some sort of latent, you know, anti-black self-hatred, but I knew it was a white man that did that. And I knew it was a white supremacist that did that, in part because I read the reports that show that they're the ones doing all the cop killing in the country anyway.
Mm-hmm.
By far.
And getting captured alive.
Yeah, and getting captured alive. Exactly. So
getting captured alive. They had him. They had his name less than 24 hours after the shooting. So they knew who it was from Jump Street. They already had a relationship with this guy. You know, they already had information and run-ins with him. You understand? What that tells us, what his capture tells us, is that the white supremacist doesn't have an effective underground either. That's what it tells us. Because if they did, he'd be in Nazi heaven somewhere, chilling. You understand what I'm saying? He'd be in Nazi heaven somewhere chilling. So all this fear that we have of a black backlash, you know, when I see Muslims, you know, I see Muslim women being beaten and the hijab ripped off them in France or here, they're burning black churches and all of this stuff. And all we come out to say is, you know, that this is Islamophobia, this community is terrified and all of this stuff. How are you going to be terrified? Ain't nothing them crackers could do to you you can't do to them. You know? And so where's all of this coming from? Where's all of this fear coming from? This fear is coming from the fact that people really believe that the state and this white supremacy and these white extremists are united. And they are to a certain degree, to a certain extent. But they managed to consolidate this power over a period of time when we did not resist. That's how they consolidated the power in the first place. Okay? There's a lot of, you know, they tell us about the military and it's a volunteer army. You and I are old enough to remember when the army was a draft. There was a draft. You know, we remember that. Okay? Now you have a volunteer army who always had a problem of recruiting people. You know, enough people to man the empire. You see? So they go through all of this, you know, patriotic jingoism and holding, you know, everything, you know, holding up these servicemen as patriots who serve. 85% of the people that go into the military today go in for economic reasons.
Oh, I feel like that's low. I feel like 85% is low.
Yeah, I'm trying to be conservative here. I would say 85% go in there for economic
Absolutely.
Reasons, to get a job, to get skills so that when they come out, they can get a job, to get lifetime insurance and health care and everything, to give their families access to these things. This is why they go into the military. They're not going in there for no red, white, and blue.
And also paper. To avoid criminal punishment. I mean, how I ended up in the military and a lot of people. In fact, when we were in the Baltimore processing station, I'll never forget this, the recruiter came out and said, we know people are enlisting to avoid criminal charges and we'll hit you with fraudulent enlistment if you are doing that before you've gone to court. And they said, if all of you who are in this room who are doing that need to stand up and move to the you know, line up against the wall. Me and everybody else got up.
Everybody went over to the wall.
Everybody else got up.
So and then you have a significant minority of all of these a white supremacist and racist who are going into the military as future preppers and as future individuals who feel that they need this training and they need this type of activity and this type of connections into the military industrial complex in order to fight what they see as a coming race war. You see what I'm saying? Black folks ain't joining the military for that reason, to get some skills to we ain't doing it. We doing it more or less for the economic. We doing it for the employment. We doing it for the skills. We doing it for more benign reasons. But it's still the instrument of violence that belongs to the state. And it's the same way we know about the police. We know that a lot of the black cops don't go into the police department to serve the black community. They go in for job security. They know they can't get fired after probation. And a lot of them was punks when they was in the community. And now they get a chance to carry a gun and punk everybody else. You see, and so we know a lot of them suckers that's law enforcement. We know a lot of them got all of this heart because they got the whole state apparatus and all of this bureaucracy to back them up when they do something. Okay, and we know a lot of them got a criminal mentality. They just too much of a pussy to carry it out, so they do it as a cop. Okay, so we know all of this crap. All of this stuff about law enforcement and serving the community, they put their lives on the line every day. It's all bullshit. You know, maybe you have to edit that part. It's all crap. You understand? People go the subject, and that's what I ended my letter with. The subjective factor is the dynamic factor in struggle. The subjective factor. It's the dynamic factor in war. It's the dynamic factor in freedom struggle. It's the dynamic factor. It's the only factor that you can't put into a computer and program. It's the human factor, the human motivations. And what I'm saying is that when we dissect history, and I understand what you're saying, and you know, I got to cop to that. I got to cop to that, you know, the point that you're trying to play that role, you understand, is exactly what I would want my teacher to play. If I was in school, I would love to have a teacher like you. You know, it was a history teacher similar to yourself that put me on the idea and the notion of studying history. He made history very, very interesting. He made it personal. He showed me the subjective factor. He showed me, taught me about how George Washington might have been scared shitless when he was crossing that river. Never occurred to me that the dude standing in the boat might be scared. You see what I'm saying? And I guess that's the part that I'm missing. You know, that Nat Turner, history didn't make Nat Turner, he made history. And he made history with all of his limitations, with all of his human foibilities, with all of his fears and his intrepidation. He stood forward and did it. Whether snitches was gonna snitch, whether crackers was not gonna like him, he didn't care. And that's what I'm saying is where a lot of young black folks are at right now. They're at that position where they don't really care about none of that. You know, just show me how to do this. You know, just show me how to do it with a chance of winning or coming out on top. You know, or at the very least, let them write my name in history like they wrote Nat Turner's. Okay, and I think that that's sufficient for them. Okay, but they don't have the type of leadership. They don't have the type of brain power that you guys. You guys exercise more brain power in one analysis than most of these young dudes exercise their whole life on the streets. You see what I'm saying? And it's not that they opposed to what you got to say. It's not that they look at you as the enemy. You know, they will look at you and say, ah, man, that's one of them intellectuals. What did he know, man? He ain't never had to struggle out in the street and cop and blow. But you might have to remind him, look, man, I ain't grew up in no ivory tile. Now, I came out of the south side of Baltimore or wherever, you know.
I didn't come out of any of those kinds of communities.
No, but I'm saying.
You know, but I got you. You get it. I got you.
Academicians that have that.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
You understand? So you can't really pull the wool over their eyes with that. Say, look.
All I would want to add to that, all I like to just throw in a little bit is that not everybody that didn't grow up in that condition is a punk either. That's all I would want to throw out there.
I know
that's all I'm saying.
I mean, it's like in jail. Everybody think that to be gay means that you a punk. It don't mean that in terms of manhood. Because I've known gay men in prison that'll knock your monkey ass out. You understand what I'm saying? Quick, fast, and in a hurry. You understand what I'm saying? So there was nothing punk about them. If you just want to classify punk on some macho masculinity, you understand? You can forget that part.
But listen, unfortunately, I gotta wrap this up. I greatly appreciate you getting at me with the criticism. I even more appreciate you having this conversation. And I deeply appreciate your past work, your current work, and your presence in offering your analysis. Daruba Bin Wahad, thank you again for joining us in this edition of I Mix What I Like.
Thank you, brother. And you know how I feel about revolutionary intellectuals. You understand? Y'all have a job to perform. It's just that when I hear some of these interviews, man, it's like, damn, man. You know, what does it feel like? This is what you got to get across to these to brothers and sisters. What does it feel like to be hunted?
So say it real quick, and if you can give it to us in just a couple of minutes, what did it feel like? What did it feel like to stand up in armed struggle, to stand to go underground? What would you quickly want to convey if it hasn't already been conveyed?
It felt like there was nothing that they could do to me that I can't do to them. And that unless there was funerals on both sides, nobody's going to come to the negotiating table and recognize our humanity. You know, that's what it felt like, that I was tired of being a victim or watching my people victimized, and that the only organized resistance. I'm not talking about spontaneous individual go off on your top of your head stuff. This is why guys like you are so important. You see what I'm saying? So people could understand why you feel that way in a historical context, in a contemporary context. So you could understand this is a historical moment for me to step forward, you know, and do what I think I should do, regardless of the consequences. And I think that that's what happened. That was happening with us. When you have a Twyman Myers, you understand, may Allah be pleased with him. When you have a Twyman Myers that struck fear in the heart of the Joint Terrorist Task Force, to the point where when they had him cornered, they had to shoot him down like a dog. He escaped so many of their ambushes and sent so many of them to Woodlawn Cemetery that he was feared by them. We know about Osama bin Laden. What did they code name the operation to kill bin Laden? Geronimo. Geronimo is the quintessential fear of white male macho manhood. And when they jump out of plane, they scream Geronimo. You see? And that's what it felt like. It felt like, well, I'm Geronimo to your custom. You understand? And that's what it, you might get me, you might knock me off, you might knock off my comrades, but just believe that there's always going to be another one that you're going to have to deal with until we win. It's like the Vietnamese people. They won the war against the most powerful military force on the planet because they didn't know that they were supposed to lose. Nobody told them, hey, you know, you're supposed to lose this war. They said, we're going to fight you from one generation to the next. This is our country. This is our land. And you're going to leave. I'm not leaving. You see? And that's how I felt. I felt like, look, you may kill a Clifford Glover. You may kill an unarmed young black kid at 14 years old. But when I catch your ass out here on the streets dragging, you going to your maker. And believe this. I'll put out a communique and said I did it. You see, that's how arrogant I am. You know, you could hang us from a tree, you understand, to intimidate all the black folks, but we could send out a communique to inspire black folks, you see. So that's how it felt, that it was you trying to step up so that our people would not be construed as complicit and compliant in our own murder, that they didn't understand my misery. They didn't understand my grief when I had to go to a funeral, because they didn't have to go to a funeral. They don't have to deal with that. And if you notice, whenever these cops get killed, they always trot out the parents and the relatives of black people who were murdered by cops to show that there's a commonality in grieving their loved ones. They show that there's a commonality in grieving their loved ones. But they don't. But that commonality hasn't reached the point where they sit down and say, look, man, your life does matter. What can, you know, you do? You should have the power to determine your own reality. You should be able to control your own community. I'm sick of having to bury my children. You're sick of having to bury your children. Let's come to accommodation here. We're all human. We ain't reached that point because there ain't been funerals on both sides.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.